We are preparing 100 million doses of vaccine. Hopefully, by 2021, we can increase our production capacity.
Indonesia looks for its answer to coronavirus. It's Monday, August 24th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us online at Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, all under the name VOA Asia. Also ahead, a musical message for indigenous residents down under. Chinese law creeps into U.S. college campuses. Mailing in votes and views of home from far above. It's all on today's VOA Asia. More and more COVID vaccines are entering phase three of clinical trials. Several Chinese pharmaceuticals are among those developing vaccines, and Indonesia has decided to partner with them. But researchers in Indonesia are also looking to develop their own homegrown vaccine. VOA's Rendy Wixana looks at the efforts to test vaccines in the province of West Java and the capital, Jakarta.
Indonesia is starting phase three of a clinical trial for a COVID-19 vaccine in Bandung, in the province of West Java. The long-awaited vaccine is being developed in cooperation with Sinovac, a biopharmaceutical company from China. Trials with Sinovac are also being rolled out in Brazil, Bangladesh, and the UAE. Indonesia is testing the vaccine on more than 1,600 volunteers, among them West Java Governor Ridwan Kamil, who volunteered himself. Medical researchers from a local university, Universitas Pajajaran, handle the lab work.
We will monitor them for 6 months and see if the vaccine works effectively. Volunteers are vaccinated twice. Then we will schedule a monthly phone supervision. However, volunteers are able to reach our team at all times when they feel unwell.
Volunteers must be local residents of Bandung, aged between 18 to 59 years old, with no history of chronic disease. They are also asked to stay in the area for the next 6 months. Volunteers receive free health insurance coverage and a free swab test, but no compensations. The goal is to complete phase 3 by January and produce the vaccine by March 2021. Indonesian pharmaceutical company Bio Farma will handle the productions.
To start, we are preparing 100 million doses of vaccine. Hopefully, by 2021, we can increase our production capacity to 250 million doses per year.
Indonesia is the world's fourth most populous nation, with 260 million people. Medical experts say they will need at least 350 million doses of the vaccine produced by Indonesia. For that reason, they are also working to produce their own vaccine.
Because imported vaccine cannot necessarily provide us 350 million doses of vaccine directly, since they also need to supply other countries, both for commercial or aid purpose. The key to successful vaccination is sustainability. That is the most important.
To achieve that sustainability, a Jakarta-based biomolecular lab is developing their own seed vaccine using samples from the local virus outbreak. The hope is that Indonesia could be producing its own vaccine by early 2022. From Jakarta, Indonesia, Rendy Wicaksana, VOA News.
These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Will the United States make clear-cut commitment to defend Taiwan from China? Facebook in India embroiled in political hate speech controversy. Chinese tycoon linked to Bannon accused Xi government of corruption. A timeline of 3 years looking at the Rohingya crisis. China video ad calls for 100 Uyghur women to urgently marry Han men. Find expanded coverage of all these stories and so much more on Facebook at VOA Asia, and you can stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Indigenous rappers have been brought in to help protect some of Australia's most vulnerable people from COVID-19. Throughout the pandemic, there has been a concerted effort to protect remote Aboriginal communities from the coronavirus. They already have high rates of heart, liver, and respiratory diseases, as well as diabetes and cancer. But 80% of Indigenous Australians live in towns and cities, and measures to prevent the spread of infection have been boosted by a new awareness campaign. We hear more from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
The song is called 1.5. It's about safe social distancing at 1.5 metres, and it's a message for Australia's urban Aboriginal communities. It's co-written by Mikesha Masala, a young Indigenous singer from Sydney.
For us, it was about creating a song that would encourage community to continue to stay COVID safe and to also bring a little bit of fun and pride back into isolation.
Melbourne remains under a strict lockdown after a sharp rise in COVID-19 cases. The situation in Australia's second biggest city is gradually improving, and so far, Indigenous groups have avoided large numbers of infections. Caroline Kell, an Aboriginal health official, says communities have worked hard to keep safe.
We're not seeing a great amount of transmission in and between families, unlike the broader population. So that means that people are self-isolating and quarantining effectively and stopping the spread in between families, which is a really positive thing, considering a lot of our community do live in pretty overcrowded and sort of transient accommodation.
Coronavirus has certainly changed the way we live, work, and connect. These changes can be hard for some of us and can make us feel no good in our head or spirit, like sad or worried all the time.
Some of us might. Public health campaigns are also helping Indigenous Australians in remote settlements who already suffer high rates of chronic disease in areas with limited medical facilities cope with the mental stress of the pandemic. A recent study by the University of Western Australia found the coronavirus had put many First Nation people at risk of severe psychological distress. Australia's Indigenous peoples make up about 3% of the national population. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, the Korean Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the country is on the brink of a nationwide pandemic. It points to new cases increasing in all 17 regions across South Korea. New nationwide restrictions have just begun, following 9 days of triple-digit increases in coronavirus cases. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. It's a brand new week, and we're glad to have you with us on VOA Asia. The effect of the new national security law that China imposed on Hong Kong is apparently extending far beyond the territory, all the way to U.S. college campuses. Classes at some elite universities will carry a warning label this fall. This course may cover material considered politically sensitive by China. And schools are weighing measures to try to shield students and faculty from prosecution by Chinese authorities. The issue has become especially pressing because at least the first semester at many universities will be taught online, and that means some students from China and Hong Kong will connect with their U.S. classmates via video links. Some academics fear the classes could be recorded and ultimately end up in the hands of Chinese authorities. Almost 370,000 Chinese students and roughly 7,000 from Hong Kong enrolled at U.S. universities in the 2018-2019 school year, and academics in the United States say they often opt to take classes on Chinese law, culture, and politics because they want to understand more about their country and how the world views it. Christopher Balding, an associate professor at the Fulbright University, tells VOA's Adriana Zhang most U.S. colleges and universities have not addressed several serious issues concerning China and its visiting students.
I understand where universities are coming from and that they are trying to act in the best interest of the student to keep the student safe. I think the bigger problem is that what this indicates is that universities are yielding to Chinese pressure and the very reasonable concern that they have over student safety. However, universities have absolutely no track record of speaking out about China. They have no track record about how they have sought to address historical concerns about Chinese behavior. And they appear intent on engaging in a series of practices such as accepting Chinese money and hiding it in violation of U.S. law, as well as other practices such as arguing against reasonable visa restrictions against PLA graduate students in science programs in the United States. So the individual practice taken in isolation, I don't think is necessarily the worst thing in the world. However, taken against the larger backdrop, I think it presents a very troubling behavior by U.S. professors and universities.
By doing so, would the students miss out on learning critical knowledge or skills? And would this also hurt the quality of education in the United States?
Yes, I think it is very troubling that that they would, for instance, place warning labels on classes that Beijing might consider sensitive. That is indicative of a creeping censorship by Beijing, even if it's not explicit, even if it is not mandated by law. It is very clearly indicative of the influence that Beijing censorship is having in the United States. So I do think it weakens a student's historical and in-depth knowledge of China if they're going to be allowed to opt out of things or be given warning labels on those types of events.
But you did mention that the universities are doing that to protect students. And we also saw some cases that where like Chinese nationals have been arrested or even sentenced to prison for what they did here in the United States. So what do you think about that?
Again, this is part of that larger pattern of behavior by universities that we've seen. Whether it's professors, American and Chinese, engaging in behavior such as not reporting of income or failing to disclose ties to Chinese universities or sharing unauthorized data, whether it is forms of economic espionage or coordinating their activities with Chinese consulates or the embassy. I think the bigger problem for universities is that pattern of behavior of turning a blind eye and pretending that those types of behaviors.
Christopher Balding, associate professor at the Fulbright University, speaking with VOA's Adriana Zhang.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
This news from VOA Asia. Rohingya in Bangladesh are marking 3 years since the mass exodus from Myanmar. About 1 million members of the Muslim minority live in bamboo and plastic shelters in refugee camps. Two attempts to get a repatriation process going in 2018 and 2019 failed. You'll find all the big stories throughout the day at VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We continue with VOA Asia. If you live in India or part of a family that has immigrated from there, you could very well be excited for the first woman of color on a majority party's ticket in U.S. politics. Democratic vice presidential nominee Kamala Harris is expected to galvanize the minority vote. But Harris also faces some unique challenges and opportunities as she campaigns alongside presidential nominee Joe Biden. White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Sawara has the story from Wilmington, Delaware, where Harris last week accepted her party's nomination.
A historic moment in U.S. history as Kamala Harris, the first American of Jamaican and Indian descent, accepts the Democratic Party's nomination to become Joe Biden's running mate.
We're all in this fight. You, me, and Joe. Together. What an awesome responsibility. What an awesome privilege.
Her call hits the right note with many Democratic voters.
I think a lot of young people across the country are actually applauding and feeling connected to her.
There have been two female vice presidential candidates before Harris, Democrat Geraldine Ferraro in 1984 and Republican Sarah Palin in 2008. Ferraro and Palin were selected to energize campaigns that were trailing in the polls, but Harris is joining Biden at a time when polls show him the front runner.
And so Biden is playing from real strengths and nonetheless saw fit not to shake up the race, but to kind of consolidate those advantages that he has by bringing on a woman and a woman of color. And that speaks, I think, volumes about the direction of the Democratic Party and where our country is going.
Women in American politics have long encountered additional challenges compared to their male peers, including being judged by their appearance or even their voice.
But the president's senior advisor, Jenna Ellis, just said Kamala Harris sounds like me.
And as a female candidate of color, Harris has faced extra scrutiny over her family background. Although Harris is an American citizen born in California, President Trump has not rejected false claims that Harris is ineligible because of her parents' immigration status. Ultimately, it's the voters who will decide what to believe.
As somebody with immigrant parents, you know, I don't have to prove I'm American to somebody again and again and again and again. You know, the racists are never going to believe you.
Harris, a former prosecutor, will play a key role in delivering the Democrats' most pointed attacks on the incumbent administration. Already, President Trump has called her mean and nasty, remarks some consider sexist. Still, Harris has a huge opportunity to be the future of her party.
If elected, Biden will be 78 when he's inaugurated in January, making him the oldest person to ever assume the American presidency. Biden has spoken of himself as a transitional figure and has suggested he may not seek a second term. None
of us the Democratic National Convention showcased the racial and cultural diversity of their political coalition, as well as a generational gulf in the party, something that Biden is trying to address with his 55-year-old VP pick.
You know, he's signaling his interest in handing the baton off to Harris and people who look like Harris and people who have similar outlooks as Harris and have her kind of life experience.
Which means whether or not Joe Biden wins in 2020, Kamala Harris will likely look ahead to 2024. From Wilmington, Delaware, Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
Coronavirus questions. Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of the questions is no. The best steps to take: wash your hands, cover your cough, stay at home if you are sick or advised to by local authorities.
Now on VOA Asia, the coronavirus pandemic is driving many Americans to consider voting by mail in this November's presidential election, instead of casting their ballots in public polling places. But just as the Postal Service faces a major test of its election year capabilities, congressional Democrats say the Trump administration's recent changes at the U.S. Postal Service could lead to voter suppression. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson explains the controversy.
An unprecedented level of election year mail. That's the expectation as millions of Americans resort to mailing in their ballots in this upcoming presidential election to avoid the coronavirus infection. But congressional Democrats are warning the system may not be able to keep up.
If you want to vote in person, you can. We also want to make sure if you want to vote by mail, you can. And if the mail is late, your ballot may not be counted.
This concern was raised after Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, a Republican Party fundraiser who took the position earlier this summer, announced major operational changes, including the removal of some blue collection boxes, shutting down some mail sorting equipment, and changes to post office hours and employee overtime. The president is supporting those changes.
The post office is running as well as it has in a long time.
Trump's previous criticism of mail-in voting led Democrats to say DeJoy's changes were deliberate to discourage voting by mail.
Anybody knows that it is unlawful to interfere with the post office in order to try to cook and fix and disrupt a United States election. which is what this Postmaster General was doing on the orders of Donald Trump, who told the country on national TV and via Twitter that he's interfering with the post office because he doesn't like mail-in ballots.
Democratic attorneys general in at least 20 U.S. states have said they would sue the post office for the resulting delay. In response, DeJoy announced this week he would not implement those planned changes until after the election, defending them by saying they were long planned before he assumed the post. But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi still plans to hold an emergency session of the U.S. House to vote on more funding for the post office to handle the influx of ballots.
I don't frankly trust the Postmaster General and what he said. And if he is sincere about it, it means the bully has backed off.
DeJoy will also face questioning from two congressional panels this coming week, as Democrats say some of the changes may be too late to reverse, with Election Day just a little over 2 months away. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
A man-made mega constellation orbiting Earth has grown again after another history-making commercial launch. Satellite images document a quarter century of melting ice on Earth, plus images of our home planet from space and of space from our home planet. VOA's Arash Arabasadi brings us The Week in Space.
3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition and liftoff for the Falcon 9. Go Starlink.
From Florida's Cape Canaveral, the commercial spaceflight company SpaceX launched another batch of its Starlink satellites into space. The launch marked the second Starlink mission this month and SpaceX's 14th mission so far this year. Also on board were three Earth observation satellites called SkySats. SpaceX says the Falcon 9 booster that carried the satellites set a record Tuesday, becoming the first rocket to complete six flights. The company says its Starlink network will provide high-speed broadband internet to underserved parts of the world. Also this week, scientists in the United States said they analyzed 25 years' worth of satellite data to look deep beneath the surface of Antarctica's melting ice shelves. PhD student Sushil Adesumilli studies at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego.
So usually, if you're trying to look at changes in the ocean, you take a ship there. But in Antarctica, because the ocean's under thousands of feet of ice, you have to use satellite data.
Adesumilli credits European Space Agency satellites for a quarter century's worth of measurements taken from the ice sheets in Antarctica. Radar altimeter satellites make it possible for researchers to study the data.
What they have is a radar ping, and it's a very short burst of energy. And that goes down from the satellite, which is orbiting around 500 miles above the Earth, hits the ice and comes back up. So what we do is we measure the time that the radar signal takes to hit the ice and come back up.
The faster those pings bounce back to space, the thicker the ice. NASA funded the study, which estimates the continent's ice shelves lost nearly 4,000 gigatons since 1994, producing an amount of meltwater that could almost fill the Grand Canyon. NASA astronaut Chris Cassidy captured these still images of Hurricane Genevieve from the International Space Station. The National Hurricane Center warns Genevieve could cause life-threatening flash floods and mudslides across Southern California. And finally, Russian cosmonaut Ivan Vagner captured this time-lapse of Antarctic aurora or the Southern Lights. Vagner says he also saw five objects that, at the time of this report, remain unidentified. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
That's our program. We thank you for joining us today on VOA Asia. You can continue by following us on Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We also thank our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team that helps bring this program to you every day, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, and Keith Lane. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead. Be safe. Be well.